Afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Division One of the Court of Appeals. We have two oral arguments scheduled in two separate appeals involving the marriage of Stackpool and Kazazian. And I wanted to say at the outset that, as you know, we had vacated the originally scheduled oral arguments so that the parties could have an opportunity to obtain clarification from the district court about the parties being able to both attend the oral arguments this afternoon without any fear or concern of violation of the protection order, and Judge Rappaport provided clarification, and so we're glad that both parties are here this afternoon for the oral arguments. I will review our procedures, but I just wanted to say at the outset, we will hear both oral arguments in one after the other. First, in the case of 2012 CA 682, which is the case involving the protection orders. And then after that, we'll hear the oral argument in 2012 CA 1922, which is the case involving the contempt procedures. Is that procedure satisfactory to both sides? Okay, and let me review our procedures briefly. As you know, there are 15 minutes for each side for oral argument. We have our traditional color-coded timers that begin with green, turn to amber when there are 5 minutes left, and turn red when your time is up. There's also a digital timer that you can use to track your time, and if you want to reserve time as the appellant, you can look at that to know how much time you have left for rebuttal argument. You should know that the judges have read the briefs, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record, so you may wish to focus on the oral on the legal issues rather than the facts, but of course how you present the argument is up to you. You should know there's a toggle switch on the podium that you can use to raise or lower it to suit your convenience. And you should also be aware that we post the recordings of the oral arguments on the internet. So if there are any pieces of confidential information, you may wish to be careful about how you refer to them. And finally, I would ask everybody in the audience and counsel as well, if you have a cell phone, make sure that it's turned off so that it doesn't inadvertently interrupt us during the oral arguments. So with that having been said, we're ready to proceed with the first of the two oral arguments in case 682.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nina Kazazian. I'm the appellant pro se in these appeals. My attorney registration number is 21910. We are here today because I have appealed and seek reversal by this court of the permanent protection order that was entered against me in on February 2nd, 2014. The basis for the appeal is that the district court erred as a matter of law by entering the permanent civil protection order, which I'll refer to as a PPO, against Kazazian because Stackpool presented no evidence that met the criteria required under the statute CRS section 13-14-102 for entry of the underlying temporary protection order, the mutual no contact order, or the permanent protection order at issue in this appeal. In addition, appellant Kazazian, me, was denied due process of law because the hearing was held after in the middle of a contempt proceeding in which punitive sanctions were sought, and I was denied the right to counsel during the punitive hearing. And the PPO hearing followed on the heels of the first day of the contempt proceeding. It was started at 6:40 p.m. I had no prior notice of that start time, and in fact, it was contrary to an order that was issued by the court on January 25th, 2012, which specifically stated that the PPO hearing would follow the conclusion of the contempt proceedings. I did not waive my right to have counsel during the punitive portion of the contempt or at the PPO. Instead, the court required me to choose between my constitutional right to liberty or my constitutional right under the Fifth Amendment to remain silent. The fact at issue in the contempt proceeding for which punitive sanctions were sought was the very same fact that was the subject of the PPO hearing, to wit, the service of a notice to quit on the appellant's residence, which was a shared house under the marital estate. Third, the district court erred in awarding Stackpool's attorney and expert $64,000 in attorney's fees and costs. I understand there is a disagreement among the parties as to what that award was for. Part of the award was for attorney's fees and costs incurred in connection with the temporary restraining order, temporary protection order proceedings, and the PPO. It is my position that those are also at issue in this appeal. I also submit to the court that the district court also erred by denying my request for attorney's fees and costs under CRS 13-17-102, because the whole temporary restraining order proceedings and commenced on this round in October of 2011, and the PPO hearing were groundless and frivolous. There's evidence in the record that indicates that appellant's counsel, who is the same counsel during these proceedings, knew that there was insufficient evidence to warrant entry of a protection order, and all previous allegations had been dismissed voluntarily by the appellee in August of 2011.
Ms. Kazazian, let me interrupt you for a second. I have a question about the attorney's fees that you mentioned. My impression was that those attorney's fees were only in connection with the contempt proceeding. Apparently, you have a different understanding of that.
Your Honor, thank you for the question. I guess, briefly, the record could be clearer. Judge Vallejos entered an order in connection with the contempt proceedings, saying that he would award attorney's fees on one of the contempts and would reserve the issue of an award of attorney's fees on the other. It is my position that the PPO was entered as part of the remedial sanctions that were requested by the appellee. The fee affidavit that's in the record and cited in my briefs included a request for fees incurred in connection with the temporary protection order hearings and the permanent protection order. The ultimate attorney's fee award that was first entered by the court, I think it was September 12th, 2011, did not distinguish or segregate out any part of the fees.
But my question, I guess, as a follow-up is whether your understanding is that all of those attorney's fees, even if they included the TPO and the PPO, were as part of the contempt award of attorney's fees, or whether they were separately awarded under some other statute for the TPO and PPO proceedings separately.
I believe, Your Honor, in my understanding, the order that was entered awarding attorney's fees was made in connection with the contempt findings, which will be further addressed in the next appeal.
Okay, thank you.
Denial of due process People v. Abdu at 215 PC 3rd 1265 at 1267 talks about the right to counsel in a criminal proceeding and a punitive sanctions, punitive contempt sanctions are akin to a criminal proceeding. I did raise this issue numerous times before and after the hearing, and I believe that the lack of counsel during those proceedings is a due process violation which warrants reversal here by this court. And again, the standard of review I believe to be applicable is the de novo standard of review. We're talking about the interpretation of a statute, namely CRS 13-102, Fife case, the other cases cited in the opening brief established that to be the correct standard of review. Here, the court simply did not make any findings of fact, either at the temporary restraint permanent order proceedings or at the permanent temporary permanent protection order hearings. Initially, the court was required to make findings of imminent danger in order to issue a valid TPO. No such findings are in the record. In addition, the initial TPO was entered on October 3rd. It was continued a couple of times after that based on unsupported allegations or assertions by Ms. Shapiro, counsel for appellee, that attempts to service had been made. In fact, they had not. There is no evidence in the record to support those contentions. Because the temporary protection order was initially entered on October 6th of 2011, it is my contention that to hold a permanent protection order hearing on February 1st is more than 120 days, and the court did not have the right to do that.
Ms. Kazazian, excuse me. So the temporary, as I understand your position, that the permanent protection order was based in part on the temporary protection order and the mutual no contact order?
My understanding is that with respect to the permanent protection order flowed, there's an overlap. It was requested by appellee as a remedy for an alleged violation of the mutual no contact order. I will reserve addressing the validity of that order for the next appeal. To the extent that the appellee asserts that the PPO was wholly unrelated, which I don't think the record supports that conclusion, it was based on a temporary protection order. However, in either case, the temporary protection order was invalid. The mutual no contact order was also invalid because the court in neither case made any of the specific findings to support entry of those protection orders as required under the statutes. I would like to reserve some time for appeal or for rebuttal.
That's fine. You have 4 minutes and 44 seconds.
Okay. So just to wrap up this part, Your Honors.
Well, then your time is still running.
Right.
Okay.
The record indicates that the facts and findings that were necessary to follow the letter of the statute were not followed in this case. There were due process violations as well. For both of those reasons, the permanent protection order should be reversed without further proceedings in the district court. And I do request the court award attorney's fees to me on appeal pursuant to CAR 39.5 and 13-102.
Ms. Kazazian, I know I'm taking time out of your rebuttal, but I do have a question to ask you about the issue of findings by the court or lack of findings by the court for the permanent protection order. It looks like the statutes have changed since the time of your hearing. What specific statute applied at the time of your hearing, and what did it say about the requirement of findings?
Your Honor, thank you for the question. It is my understanding that the new statutes came into place last year, and they only apply to permanent protection orders and temporary protection orders that were in place, that were entered on or after July 1st, 2013. It is my understanding that because these orders at issue here were entered a year previously, or a year and a half previously, in August and October of 2011 and February of 2012, that the previous version of the statutes, which have been cited in my briefs, are the applicable law.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So you have 2 minutes and 48 seconds for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. In regard to...
Excuse me, would you state your name for the record,
please?
Oh,
I am so sorry.
Sure.
Sorry. Laura Shapiro, registration 11519, appearing on behalf of Dr. Stackpole and my associate James Cordes, registration number 42436, also appears with me as well today. I've been looking at this for so long, I just started talking, I'm sorry. Ms. Kazazian is asserting that the Dr. Stackpole presented no evidence that meets the statutory criteria for entry of a permanent protection order. And I think if the court looks at his testimony, there's volumes of testimony that satisfies the statute. And in regard to the issue of finding, if I may, I can specifically refer the court to the actual protection order that the court entered. And that's found at the record at page 5985. And it specifically states in the order, the court finds it has jurisdiction over the parties in the subject matter, that the restrained party was personally served and given reasonable notice and opportunity to be heard, that the restrained person constitutes a credible threat to the life and health of the protected persons named in this action, and sufficient cause exists for the issuance of a civil protection order.
And so, can you answer the same question that I asked Ms. Kazazian? What did the statute require at the time of the hearing?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. It's in our answer brief. And I will state while the clock is ticking, while I'm looking for that reference.
If it's in your answer brief, we can find it. You don't have to use your time for that. That's okay.
Okay. We cited the applicable section in our answer brief. And I think that there was more than adequate evidence on the record, Your Honors, about the regarding the propriety of entry.
Ms. Shapiro, you mentioned that there were volumes of evidence by Dr. Stackpole. As I understand the record, if I'm in the wrong place, tell me. It was at 7 p.m. after she left the proceedings that he testified for 12 minutes. Is that the testimony you're relying on, or were there
was
other?
It's 6:45, and all of the incidents that were referenced in his testimony were part of his affidavit that were attached to the motion, and that is accurate, that he did testify.
What I'm asking is, apart from the documents, the affidavit, was there anything else other than his testimony after she left the courtroom that night that you rely on to support the PPO?
Well, there was no further testimony and no other witnesses that evening.
Okay. Was there another hearing?
There were volumes of hearings, not specifically on that issue, but the court had observed the party's conduct throughout the course of the litigation. And we had hearings at least almost on a monthly basis until permanent orders were entered.
Did the court say, I'm relying on watching her in the courtroom or some version of what you just said? Or did he, I thought in his order he said, I've heard the testimony of Mr. Stackpole. There was no cross-examination, obviously, because she wasn't there. And that's what I'm relying on. Am I wrong?
No, you are correct.
So that is the, those are the findings that support the PPO?
That was the testimony that supported the PPO, and then the court's findings are also on the face of the PPO, if that answers your question.
And you are a domestic relations practitioner with considerable experience and high standing.
Thank you.
Have you ever seen a case where a judge held a hearing at 7 p.m. over the objection of a party, any party, who's been in the courtroom for 11 hours?
Well, in this case...
Ever before this case?
Well, let me just say first, if I may. In this case, almost every single hearing went until 7 or 8 at night. The attorney's fees hearing went until 8 o'clock at night. Some judges will stay and finish, and some won't. So in my 30 years of practice, yes, I've seen it. Is it common? It's not common that it's required, because judges are particular about, if you say it's going to be one day, it's going to be one day. So generally speaking, it doesn't happen because it's not necessary. I've seen it happen before.
Is there any law on this point?
Yes, there is. And the law is that the court has the authority to govern the course of the proceedings. And in one of the cases that we cited, it says, while a court's interest in administrative efficiency may not be given precedence over a party's right to due process and present evidence, we and that's the Gellner case. In that case, somebody's time was completely cut off and they weren't permitted by a judge to present their case in chief. In this case, Ms. Kazazian was given notice of the hearing. She was given an opportunity to present evidence. She had witnesses who had been in the hallway, and she fled the courtroom over the judge's direct orders to sit down.
The testimony you just described, did that involve the contempt issue or did it involve the PPO issue?
Which testimony, Your Honor?
You just mentioned that she had a full and fair opportunity, witnesses and so on. Was that earlier testimony from 9 or whenever the judge started until 6:30, did that involve the propriety, the PPO, or was that on the contempt?
Because
it looks like we're talking about two different things.
We are. Up until that time, it was contempt. But my understanding is that there were witnesses available for the PPO, and they were released by Ms. Kazazian. And the court, Ms. Kazazian, didn't agree to continue the temporary protection order, so the court was really in a quandary because it would expire as a matter of law. And so, given the fact that she wouldn't agree to continue it until the next month for the next hearing, the court had to proceed to hear it so that it could be entered, either or denied.
The next day, when the parties were fresh, that was out of the question?
I don't recall. I'd have to go back in the 10,000-page record and tell you all the dates that the judge gave us. But one of the dates that the judge gave us, Ms. Kazazian wasn't available for because she had, unbeknownst to us, gone to Eagle County to get a restraining order against Dr. Stackpole. That was March 9th. She didn't tell anybody that. That was the second attempt, Denver County Court and then Eagle County Court, to get a restraining order against Dr. Stackpole. And those both got consolidated into the divorce.
Ms. Shapiro, what is your response to Ms. Kazazian's contention that the district court judge had said that he would not hold a PPO hearing until the contempt hearing had been completed, and in this case, it had not been completed.
That's correct. I think we had, and I could be wrong, but I think we had completed our case in chief at that point. The next contempt part of it was her part. But the judge had no choice because the expiration of the temporary protection order was going to happen.
Well, now I understand that, mm-hmm. that your concern about keeping the TPO in effect, but what is your response to Ms. Kazazian's argument that if she had stayed, that she might have been subject to incriminating herself because the contempt proceeding had not been completed, and as I understand it, Dr. Stackpole was seeking punitive as well as remedial contempt sanctions.
Well, the court only entered remedial.
No, I understand that, but from the standpoint of all of you in the courtroom at that point, that criminal contempt was still on the table.
Right,
Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And she still would have been able to cross-examine Dr. Stackpole, and she would have been able to present her witnesses. And she chose to do neither. She fled the courtroom.
Well, left the courtroom. Did she run out and slam the door?
Well, I don't know. The door shuts by itself. But she packed up and said, I'm not sitting down. I'm not sitting down. The judge said, sit down, and she fled.
In the 80s, we had a lawyer actually broke the door on the way out.
No, I don't think she did that. So, should I proceed?
Of course.
Okay. So, I think that the court needs to take notice of the fact that we were supposed to start the hearing at 9 o'clock, and we didn't start the hearing until 10:30 because Ms. Kazazian spent an hour and a half arguing over whether or not we should have a court reporter. And her dilatory tactics during the day put herself in the position that she was in. She used 65% of the hearing time that first day, and that was our case. On page 6745, the court can note that the court took a 5-minute break, and 7 minutes later, Ms. Kazazian was still outside the courthouse. In terms of get to my page.
How did this case get so out of hand? For 2-year marriage with no children? You're talking about $64,000 in attorney's fees. I'm not questioning your fees, mm-hmm. but how did this?
First of all, the parties cohabited for 9 months, even though legally they were together. And after a 9-month cohabitation, we have 5 appeals pending before this court. One was dismissed already. I can't tell you, and I really don't think I should answer that question,
okay.
to be honest.
Fine,
with you.
I apologize
no,
for asking.
No, that's okay. the court's orders on page 5803 talk about notice. And Ms. Kazazian, on the record on page 6898, states lines 15 through 16, and this was in February, the day that we were in court, so this goes to your questions, Your Honor. She said, the PPO is scheduled for today, and I relied on that. So a notice doesn't tell you what time the hearing will be. It tells you what time the hearing starts. And there was a notice that the hearing was to start at 8:30 or 9 that morning.
Ms. Shapiro,
yes.
Pardon me. I
mm-hmm.
want to clarify the contempt. It's my understanding that at some point Ms. Kazazian went ahead and testified and
yes,
that the
did.
Trial court found there was not enough evidence for punitive contempt.
Correct.
Can you put that in chronology for me? Was that on that first day?
No, that was in March.
That was in the subsequent hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That was, I think, March 30th. I'm not sure. The first hearing date in March was continued. So she was, and I was going to just say to the court that the talked about sort of mixing up the issues with the attorney's fees. Our attorney's fees were solely on the transfer of the Albion property in violation of the automatic temporary injunction. Our attorney's fees were not related in any way to the TPO or the PPO, and our affidavit is very clear in that respect. We were ordered $60,000 in fees and $4,000 expert witness costs, and I don't know how the court could have erred in denying her request for fees because she lost on the merits of both of all the cases that we were in front of Judge Vallejos on. In terms of her right to counsel, that's not even raised, I don't believe, in her opening brief, so I'm not going to respond to that. In terms of the TPO hearing being set out too far from its initial entry, it was agreed on the record on November 1st that by her attorney at that time, David Kaplan, that it would continue by agreement until the February 1st hearing. So that argument is without merit. So, let's see.
Ms. Shapiro, I see that your time is up.
Close. It says it's 14.
Oh, no, it's going up, so that means your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
So, thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to just address 2 points. The first is that Ms. Shapiro and Appelli have asserted that the court had no choice but to proceed at that time. I think this court, I trust, understands the Geller case. The other cases that are cited in my briefs, which established that the court may not put its administrative needs in front of the constitutional rights of a party. And in this case, that's exactly what the court did. There was not an opportunity to meaningfully participate in the PPO hearing. Ms. Shapiro's assertion that there were witnesses waiting in the hallway, I would note, although that is essentially her testimony because it's not in the record, it isn't true. The court simply, and also with respect to the continuance to February 1st, on November 1st, I believe it was, Ms. Shapiro required that she would not continue anything unless everything, tying the contempt and the PPO together at that time, were set out to February 1st. But the point is, the court had a very simple option here. The court could have done what it frankly was required to do under the statute, which is dismiss the TPO, and if appellee believed that he was under imminent danger or that there was something to support the entry of a TPO at all he had to do was refile. That didn't happen. And frankly, appellee took the risk of that when he insisted that the hearing be set out to February 1st. He took that risk when he opposed my motion to set the PPO on a different day so that there were not these problems. Prior to the February 1st hearing, I asked the court for additional time. I notified the court that I believed that one day for the contempt hearing was not going to be sufficient, given the number of witnesses that Apelli had disclosed. I believe it is a novel theory for Apelli to assert that by asserting legal rights, which is all I did, and that was the sole evidence presented by Stackpole in support of the TPO.
Excuse me, your time is up, Ms. Kazazian.
That my liberty rights and due process should be denied. Thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you. That concludes the arguments for the first appeal, and we can move right into the second appeal involving the contempt issues. Before we do that, I just want to say that I forgot to announce before that Judge Dunn and I are pleased to be joined by Senior Judge Sandra Rothenberg this afternoon, and we're glad that she's joining us for these oral arguments. So we're ready, Ms. Kazazian, if you want to begin with the appeal in 2012 CA 1922.
Why, thank you, Dan.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Nina Kazazian. I'm the appellant pro se in this appeal, attorney registration number 21910. This appeal, 12 CA 1922, seeks reversal of two district court post-decree contempt findings against appellant. One regarding an alleged violation of a mutual no-contact order that was entered sua sponte by the court after dismissal of the party's temporary protection orders, that MNCO, if I may use the abbreviation for mutual no-contact order, was entered from the bench on August 17th, 2011. The second contempt proceeding involves an alleged violation of the automatic temporary injunction entered under CRS section 14-10-107. I'll refer to that as the ATI contempt. The assertion in the second contempt is that more than a month after the ATI expired, I engaged in a straw man transaction, and that constituted a violation of the ATI, which was no longer in effect. A third contempt citation was dismissed. That's not here. This appeal seeks reversal of both of these contempt findings for the reasons which I'll elaborate on, and also a reversal of the $64,000 award of attorney's fees and costs made not to Apelli, but to his attorney who and expert who were not parties injured by the contempt. So first, the district court erred in finding Kazazian in contempt and entering remedial sanctions for a violation of the automatic temporary injunction. The record is described in both in all of the briefs is clear. The parties actually agree that the court entered an order on July 28th, 2011, indicating that the automatic temporary injunction would stay in effect only until August 17th, 2011, the end of the permanent orders hearing. Apelli has misconstrued this fact and asserted that the court's order clearly stated it was through permanent orders. I would suggest or submit respectfully that the fair read of the record doesn't support that. In fact, the automatic temporary injunction expired on August 17th and was not in effect. A month later, on September 19th, 2011, when I engaged in a straw man transaction to break the joint tenancy on the marital home.
Ms. Kazazian, the statute involving the automatic temporary injunction says that it will remain in effect until one of three eventualities occurs. One is the final decree, and another is the final order, a further order of the court, but it doesn't say whichever comes first or whichever comes last. So what is your interpretation of that statute?
My interpretation of the statute, as I think is somewhat explained in the reply brief, is that those provide options and the court has the discretion to determine when the automatic temporary injunction expires. In this case, the judge, at my specific request, said that the ATI expired on August 17th. It was my understanding, as the record and the testimony on July 28th and during the contempt proceedings, July 28th, 2011, and at the contempt proceedings indicates, it was my express understanding as a non-practitioner in this area and as a pro se party at that time, because my counsel had been let go or allowed to withdraw, and based on the representations of appellee's attorney at that hearing, which are on the record, that the in the absence of the court's order on July 28th, because he bifurcated the decree of dissolution in this case, which is not usual, arguably was not proper here, that's not before the court, the temporary injunction would otherwise expire upon entry of the decree of dissolution. Normally, decrees of dissolution are entered at the same time as permanent orders. That's what the law prefers. That's not what the court did here, and that was, I understand it, at the request of appellee. It was not at my request. So in this instance, factually, because the decree was entered, I believe, on the 28th, of July, I then asked for clarification at the hearing about whether the ATI survived, and at that point the judge said it would be in place until the 17th of August.
Do you have a cite in the record for that?
The cite is in my brief, if that's okay.
Yes.
But that is in there. Contempt require, if I can just skip ahead for a second, the contempt requires a showing that there was a valid order that was in place, that the alleged contemnor, in this case myself, knew of the order and hadn't complied with it and had the present ability to comply with it. None of those factors were proven up during the contempt hearing. Most notably, at the contempt hearing, appellee provided absolutely no evidence whatsoever regarding the validity of the ATI on September 19th, 2011. The record is totally devoid of that. Instead, the court just assumed. That would be an abuse of discretion if that were the standard, which I would submit to the court is not the standard of review here. The correct standard is de novo, because we're talking about the interpretation of Rule 107, CRCP 107. So even if it were somehow true that the court interpretation was different during the contempt hearing than it was on July 28th and August 17th, 2011, I had no way to know that. There's nothing in the record that advised me of that. There's no order, only the order saying from the bench that on July 28th, 2011, the ATI would be extended to August 17th, 2011. And at that time, the court knew he wasn't going to have permanent orders done at that time. So I believe the record is clear as to the court's intent and that the statute permitted the Judge Vallejos to the district court to do exactly what it did, which is just keep the ATI in place until shortly after the decree of dissolution was entered.
So your position is, as a matter of law, the ATI ended before you did the straw man? And the straw man was done to, because you had a joint tenancy with your spouse?
Yes.
Ex-spouse?
Yes.
Okay.
It is my position that the ATI was not in effect, and I didn't know about it. And, you know, I've learned a lot through this process, but at the time, I didn't have any experience in domestic relations, certainly not in a litigated case like this. So, You know, I did note that on August 1st, before August 17th, Apelli canceled my health insurance. I believe that if the ATI, well, I thought that would be a violation of the ATI, but Judge Vallejos determined that it wasn't. Yes, the straw man transaction occurred to break joint tenancy because in a late night research session, which is about all I was doing at that time, I realized because of the current status of that jointly owned house, if something were to happen to me, it would not be divided by the marital estate. It would pass directly to Apelli.
And vice versa.
Correct. And that was my understanding at the time. This testimony is in the record. That was the motivation. Moreover, I think even on this, now we need to get to the next point in my analysis, which is that even if this were a contemptuous act, which under the first two requirements, it isn't. There was no valid order. A straw man transaction is not a transfer. It didn't take it out of the marital estate. Then we get to the third part, which is that before the contempt citation was even issued on this point, the property had been transferred back to Apelli in accordance with the permanent orders. Deeds were provided in accordance with Colorado law. They were transferred in accordance with Colorado law on October 27th. The citation for contempt wasn't issued until November 1st. So
Ms. there was... Ms. Shapiro's brief said that your expert, Willis Carpenter, said that he thought that having title insurance would be a good idea. Is that a correct statement? And if so, doesn't it suggest that the retransfer of the property on your part still left some uncertainties?
Well, first of all, as I understand it, Your Honor, the testimony that you're referring to is not in the record. However, I will say that I vaguely recall something like that, but the more pertinent testimony was that Mr. Willis Carpenter and, in fact, Apelli's own experts both testified that there was no cloud on title, specifically that there was no cloud on title. The title was, after the straw man transaction, was in a condition that was better than marketable title. It was insurable. Actually, I'm getting these two mixed up, but there was testimony, which is cited in my briefs, that indicates that, frankly, the evidence at the hearing did not support Judge Vallejo's finding that there was a cloud on title. On the contrary, and even if title insurance might be generally a good idea, in this case, it was an inappropriate remedy for contempt because the only findings were for remedial sanctions, and requesting a title insurance policy does not force compliance with an order. And in fact, at that point in time, the property had already been transferred. Any contempt had been purged. So the order that was issued by the judge didn't meet the criteria of Rule 107, frankly, unfortunately, in any respect.
Ms. Kazazian, your time is running down, so if you might want to address the other contempt.
Yes, the other contempt. The other contempt regarding the mutual no contact order. The mutual no contact order that was entered on August 18th was also entered in violation of the statute. It is clear that the civil protection order statutes include mutual no contact orders as within the definition of a mutual protection order under the statute that was in effect at that time on 1314. 102, and there were no findings of fact. In fact, the court, to support entry of an order for either party, there can be no waiver or acquiescence, certainly not any knowing waiver when I was there without counsel. And the fact that the court recognized that it was to keep the peace indicates that it's impossible to even infer from the record that there was any imminent danger or any of the other evidence necessary of domestic violence, stalking, or physical harm to support entry of such an order. That needs to be reversed as well, the contempt on that issue. In addition, having a legal service to process, appellee agrees that an MNCO cannot preclude that. This particular MNCO didn't. There was no violation of the MNCO, and it was not a valid order. Again, the criteria required under Rule 107 was not satisfied with respect to the second contempt. For the reasons stated here and also in the briefs, I request that the court, without further remand, reverse both of the contempt findings and the attorney's fee award. In both cases, the contempts were at most one-time occurrences, which had been purged or couldn't be purged, and under Webb v. Christensen, no attorney's fee award could be made, and the court failed to make findings to support an attorney's fee award. There were no findings of reasonableness, necessity, or even an allocation of the amounts, and contrary to appellee's assertions, affidavits indicate that they were asking for everything on both. And I also request an award of attorney's fees in this appeal. And I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kazazian.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Laura Shapiro, registration 11519, on behalf of Dr. Stackpole, the appellee, and James Cordes, registration 42436, appears with me as well. I think we need to separate out the issues that are before the court. And first, we have, I'd like to address the mutual no contact order. The court entered this order after observing roughly 8 to 9 months of behavior in court. And under its power and equity, it had the ability to do so. And if the court recalls, you probably memorized more cases than I can even imagine, but the Martin case, there are cases where the court can restrict parties' contact with children. Certainly, it can restrict parties' contact with each other.
So, Ms. Shapiro, just to be clear, I think what you're saying is similar to what you said in your briefs. Are you agreeing that the statutory basis for a mutual no-contact order was not satisfied here?
And no.
I thought you were arguing that the court was acting under its general equitable powers.
It was. It is. And so could you repeat your question?
Because you're saying that the court was acting under its general equitable powers, does that also mean that you are agreeing that the court did not satisfy the statutory basis for entering a mutual no-contact order?
Thank you. I'm saying it doesn't have to, because it didn't enter a protection order, and the remedies are very different. If you violate a protection order, you get arrested. If you violate a mutual no contact order, you can be in contempt, but you can't get arrested. So it's a very different kind of order. And I would also submit to the court that Ms. Kazazian agreed. The court said, well, I guess it's to your benefit not to have the restraining order and have a no contact order. And Ms. Kazazian, and this is in the record 7734, said Ms. Kazazian said absolutely. And she then negotiated for changes to the mutual no contact order so that she could, in an emergency, go to certain hospitals where Dr. Stackpole might practice And so the court entered an order permitting her to be able to do that. So we believe it was agreed upon. And in any event, you know, a party under the it's the Topanz case, which is cited in our brief, you know, a party can't pick and choose which orders they're going to abide by. There are remedies. If you think an order is invalid, you can apply to the court to have it changed. So an order issued by a court with jurisdiction over the subject matter and the person must be obeyed until it's reversed by orderly and proper proceedings. And so the MNCO, the court she had notice, and there was an opportunity to be heard, and the PPO was not a remedy for the violation of the MNCO, mutual no contact order, because the PPO was entered prior to any finding of contempt. There were no attorney's fees awarded in regard to any violations of the MNCO. They were clearly just on the Albion property.
So for the contempt for the violation of the MNCO was for the posting of a notice to quit on the marital home, is that correct?
And that's correct, because as far back as April 3rd, 2011, it was, if the court looks at the notice to quit, specifically says, I have nowhere else to live and I want to live there. And I want possession and you owe me $19,000. Well, April 13th, 2011, the court had already awarded Dr. Stackpole use of that property. And so to start an eviction proceeding and try to get possession of his house when you were ordered not to go to the other person's residence or try to gain entry, it is absurd, and that was before the entry of permanent orders. And the other issue in regard to that posting of the notice is that there's, if you read the record, you know, Ms. Kazazian emailed me and said, will you accept service of the accrued FED? And I said, what FED? And then in another email, I asked her what was going on, and this is before I knew about the notice, and she wrote back to me and she said, what FED? And she testified in court that she never intended to start legal process. So it was purely harassment. It was contact for the purposes of harassment.
Ms. Shapiro, excuse me. As I understand the testimony in the record, a process server posted the notice. That doesn't seem to be disputed. Is that correct?
Well, the judge found that somebody else other than she posted the notice.
And the MNCO, as I read it, has nothing related to communications by third parties like a process server. So is it your contention that employing a third party to post is still a violation of the MNCO or not?
Well, the violation of the MNCO wasn't just the posting of the notice. It was trying to gain entry into his home. It was a notice that I want your house, and the court had already awarded him temporary use of the house. So that's violating the mutual no contact order. Clearly states that you're not to go to each other's residences, and this wasn't just going to his house, it was saying I want your house. So that to me, in when you take it as a whole, is the violation. In addition, the court didn't award fees, and under Webb, if this court finds that Webb applies, the contempt finding was confirmed, and there were no fees awarded in that case because it couldn't be purged. In our case, there were no fees awarded, so there's no harm that stemmed from the finding of the contempt. And in Webb, the contempt finding stood, even though you couldn't award attorney's fees. So, then Willis Carpenter did testify. If we go to the ATI, the parties can't, and it's in our brief, well, actually, I'm not sure that it is. It's a case that I cited in a motion. And that case is Aravello against the Colorado Department of Human Services, 72 P3D 436. And that case stands for the proposition that the parties cannot agree away the force of law. So if we go to court and say in August that homicide is legal, I mean, you can't agree that the law is what it isn't. So whether or not we agree, Ms. Kazazian is held to a higher standard. She is a practicing attorney. And she transferred Albion to a Delaware corporation about which we knew nothing, had never been disclosed in disclosures. And she didn't need to do a straw man transaction. She could have just transferred it to herself if she wanted to do that. She could have applied to the court. And Dr. Stackpole, if something did happen to her, would have been left with dealing with the probate court in trying to get the house that he was ultimately awarded back into his name. So that's the issue with that.
Ms. Shapiro, could you respond to Ms. Kazazian's argument that the ATI was no longer in effect at the time she transferred the house in this straw man transaction?
It was in effect, Your Honor, because it was before the entry of permanent orders. And that's what I'm saying. You can't agree to change the force of law.
Well, and what specific statutory language are you relying on for that
statement? I'm saying that it stays in effect until entry of the decree or judgment. And judgment, in my view, is permanent orders. Because
right,
one could divest themselves of every single asset in the marital estate before the property division enters by the court.
Well, assuming that you're correct about that interpretation, the statute also says that the ATI, as one alternative, remains in effect until further order of court. And as I understand Ms. Kazazian's argument, she said that Judge Vallejos had specifically said that the ATI would remain in effect until August 17th.
Well, I don't know that he limited it to that. He just said on her request that at least it would remain in effect that long. I don't know that he limited it to that date.
Well, if you're correct that you're not sure if he limited it to that date, I'm just wondering how somebody would know whether or not the ATI was in effect through permanent orders or just until August 17th.
Well, if Dr. Stackpole had depleted his retirement account or transferred his interest in his practice, I can guarantee you we would have been in court on contempt for depleting the marital estate. And so how does one know? One has nine lawyers that one could have consulted, one of nine. She's an attorney herself. You do the research before you take it into your own hands and put an asset out of the reach of the court. In addition, there were at least three or four deeds with dates that were false that were presented. So the act was not purged by the time that we got to court. In fact, it was made worse because the dates were falsified and the legal descriptions were incorrect. And what I would like to point out to the court is that in regard to the mutual no contact order, and I know I'm going back and forth, but I'm trying to get everything in. In January of 2012, Ms. Kazazian filed a motion for contempt alleging that Dr. Stackpole violated the no contact order. So that was in January of 2012, and therefore she's taking advantage of the fact that the mutual no contact order was in existence. And if the court looks at the record at page 0437, we had filed a motion for a mutual no contact order, so it wasn't just sua sponte that the court entered it. We had filed a motion and requested that before entry of permanent orders. There's some more information that I would like to talk about on the ATI.
Your client has, there were two places in the record where he described the alleged act by Ms. Kazazian of trying to run him over. In one area in the record, there was an allegation that she tried to run Dr. Stackpool and his daughter over. There was another version where she was leaving in a rage or emotionally and backed up sharply, but there was no indication that she attempted to hit him. Were those two separate incidents or two different versions?
I think we're confusing two incidents. One incident was when she actually ran over his foot and he had surgery because his ankle was broken. And another incident was when she took the police to the house on Albion to retrieve a dog bowl and dog shampoo, and he was in the alley in a car with his daughter, and she backed up, almost hitting his car.
His car?
Yes.
Did she hit the car?
I don't believe so. I think...
Almost?
Yes.
Thank you.
And in terms of evidence on the record about why the court entered the mutual no contact order, if you look at permanent orders on page 5117, the court notes the incredible level of acrimony, needless litigation. The court ballooned to five volumes filled with motion and pleadings, often filed without permission.
What was that transcript number?
5117.
Thank you.
5118, the matter upon filing became extremely acrimonious. Page 5119, the amount of litigation and filings, petitioner at that point had gone through four lawyers. 5120, the court says, the court notes that this two-day hearing went to a fourth day, due in great part to the histrionics and theatrics of petitioner. So the court had volumes of evidence before it, and it was not an abuse of its discretion to enter the orders that it did.
Ms. Shapiro?
Yes.
Ms. Kazazian stated that the permanent orders hearing was never meant to be one day. Is that accurate?
You mean the contempt?
No, the permanent orders hearing.
Permanent orders, I just was reading about it, was 2 days. I think she was referring to contempt.
It was set for 2 days?
It was set for two. It went for four.
Okay. And it was supposed to start August 17th?
Yeah. No, it was in July, I believe.
July. Sorry. Okay.
Ms. Shapiro, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you both again for your oral arguments this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate your accommodating your schedule so that we could hold the oral arguments this afternoon. That concludes the oral arguments in both of these cases. The cases will stand submitted and written opinions will issue in due course. And that concludes the arguments for Division 1. And the court will be in recess and the bailiff may so announce.